Hello, this is Nicolene Ambrose with the Tri-County Journal for Wednesday, January 27th. First article, COVID-19 vaccine update from the Douglas County Health Department. As the state of Illinois prepares to move into phase 1B of the COVID-19 vaccination process, DCHD would like to inform the public about what that is and how it will be accomplished locally. Perhaps the most important thing to remember is that everything depends upon available vaccine supply. While eligible recipients likely number in the thousands, we can only dispense what we have in our possession. That said, rest assured that there will be no wasting of vaccine. Our mission is to make sure every single available dose we have gets into the arm of a willing vaccine recipient. Douglas County is receiving the Moderna vaccine, a two-dose regimen that requires at least a 28-day interval between doses. It is authorized for ages 18 and older. DCHD has weekly recurring vaccine clinic dates and times planned. Wednesdays, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Arcola Center, and Thursdays, 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. at Tuscola Community Building, starting the last week in January, but will not open registration until we know we have sufficient vaccine. Watch DCHD social media sites and county newspapers for updated information and opportunity to pre-register online for these clinics. Pre-registration is strongly encouraged to help streamline the process and make sure we have sufficient vaccine for all accepted appointments. It is highly recommended that if you don't have access to a computer or other device, enlist the help of a family member or friend to do so for you. Once you have pre-registered for a vaccine clinic appointment, please be sure to bring a printed copy of the appointment ticket or have a photo of it on your smartphone. We will be scanning that ticket at check-in. You will have to bare your arm for the vaccine, so it would be helpful to wear a short-sleeved shirt or something that easily allows access to your bare upper arm for the injection. You will receive an immunization card at your appointment with the date and dosage information of your first vaccine. It will also list the date for which you are eligible to receive your second dose. You will be asked to repeat the online pre-registration process for this dose as well. For those folks who took our now closed online COVID vaccine survey, DCHD will be attempting to reach you via HyperReach to inform you of clinic registration openings for when they are available. Watch for a phone number starting with 217-599. Listed below are the population demographics included in Phase 1B. 1B eligible individuals as determined by CDC and IDPH. First, people age 65 plus. Next, first responders, fire, law enforcement, 911 workers, security personnel, school officers. Next, education, teachers, principals, student support, student aides, daycare workers, and food agriculture processing, plants, veterinary health, livestock services, animal care. Then manufacturing, industrial production of goods for distribution, corrections workers and inmates, public transit workers, flight crew, bus drivers, train conductors, taxi drivers, paratransit drivers, grocery store workers, baggers, cashiers, stockers, pickup, customer service, and shelters, adult daycare, homeless shelters, women's shelters, adult day programs, PSR programs. What you can expect at your vaccine appointment. Vaccine recipients will be asked for their pre-registration ticket and will fill out a brief questionnaire, after which the painless injection will be administered. Out of an abundance of caution, recipients will be asked to wait 15 minutes before leaving to ensure there are no adverse reactions. The most common side effect is a sore arm at injection site, and mild fatigue is occasionally reported. The second dose should be administered at least 28 days after the first dose. Recipients will receive the vaccines free of charge. This is a brief overview of what DCHD anticipates the vaccine process to look like. Thank you for your continued patience as we work through the state and federal guidelines governing us to make this effort as efficient and fair as possible. Next article, Illinois Department of Public Health announces Region 6 moves to Phase 4. The Illinois Department of Public Health, IDPH, announced Region 6, which includes the following counties: Champaign, Clark, Clay, Coles, Crawford, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Effingham, Fayette, Ford, Iroquois, Jasper, Lawrence, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Richland, Shelby, and Vermilion is returning to Phase 4 of the Restore Plan, and Region 7, Kankakee and Will Counties, is advancing to Tier 1. Information about which tier and phase regions are in can be found at the top of the IDPH website homepage. I am excited that 10 out of our 11 regions have moved out of Tier 3 mitigations, said IDPH Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike. However, this does not mean we can let our guard down. We must continue to practice actions to protect ourselves from the virus, wear our masks, avoid large gatherings, and get the vaccine when it is our turn. This is particularly critical as new variants circulate, which early studies show spread much more rapidly. We are headed in the right direction once again, so let's stay the course. IDPH will continue to closely monitor test positivity, ICU bed availability, and the number of people in the hospital with COVID-19. Should data show regions trending in the wrong direction, based on the established mitigation metrics, regions could once again find themselves in a higher tier with increased measures. Metrics for moving from a higher to lower tier are as follows. Moving from Tier 3 to Tier 2, test positivity rate greater than or equal to 8% and below 12% for 3 consecutive days, a 7-day average, and staffed ICU bed availability greater than or equal to 20% for 3 consecutive days, 7-day average, and sustained decline in COVID patients in hospital, 7-day average for 7 of 10 days. Moving from Tier 2 to Tier 1. Test positivity rate between 6.5% and 8% for 3 consecutive days, 7-day average, and staffed ICU bed availability greater than or equal to 20% for 3 consecutive days, 7-day average, and no sustained increase in COVID patients in hospital, 7-day average for 7 of 10 days. Moving from Tier 1 to Phase 4. Test positivity rate less than or equal to 6.5% for 3 consecutive days, 7-day average, and staffed ICU bed availability greater than or equal to 20% for 3 consecutive days, 7-day average, and no sustained increase in COVID patients in hospital, 7-day average for 7 of 10 days. Information about mitigation and resurgence metrics can be found on the IDPH website at http://www.dph.illinois.gov/regionmetrics. Next article, Douglas County Tentative Property Assessment Equalization Factor announced. Douglas County has been issued a tentative property assessment equalization factor of 1.0000, according to David Harris, Director of the Illinois Department of Revenue. The property assessment equalization factor, often called the multiplier, is the method used to achieve uniform property assessments among counties as required by law. This equalization is particularly important because some of the state's 6,600 local taxing districts overlap into two or more counties, for example, school districts, junior college districts, fire protection districts. If there were no equalization among counties, substantial inequities among taxpayers with comparable properties would result. State law requires property in Illinois to be assessed at one-third of its market value. Farm property is assessed differently, with farm home sites and dwellings subject to regular assessing and equalization procedures, but with farmland and farm buildings assessed according to standards based on productivity. The equalization factor is determined annually for each county by comparing the sales price of individual property sold over the past 3 years to the assessed value placed on those properties by County Supervisor of Assessments, County Assessor. If this 3-year average level of assessment is one-third of market value, the equalization factor will be 1. If the average level of assessment is greater than one-third of market value, the equalization factor will be less than 1. And if the average level of assessment is less than one-third of market value, the equalization factor will be greater than 1. Assessments in Douglas County are at 33.40% of market value based on sales of properties in 2017, 18, and 19. The equalization factor currently being assigned is for 2020 taxes payable in 2021. Last year's equalization factor for the county was 1.0000. The tentative factor is subject to change, 1, if the County Board of Review takes actions which significantly affect the county assessments, or 2, if local officials or others can present data showing that the Department of Revenue's estimates of the average level of assessments in the county should be adjusted. A public hearing on the tentative multiplier will be held between 20 and 30 days after the tentative factor is published in a newspaper of general circulation within the county. A change in the equalization factor does not mean total property tax bills will increase or decrease. Tax bills are determined by local taxing bodies when they request money each year to provide services to local citizens. If the amount requested by local taxing districts is not greater than the amount received in the previous year, then total property taxes will not increase, even if assessments may have increased. The assessed value of an individual property determines what portion of the tax burden a specific taxpayer will assume. That individual's portion of tax responsibility is not changed by the multiplier. Next article. Millions of taxpayers will receive their second stimulus by debit card. The Treasury Department and the IRS are issuing millions of second economic impact payments by prepaid debit card to speed delivery of the payments to as many people as possible. If the hyperlink https://www.irs.gov/coronavirus/get-my-payment on irs.gov shows a date that a recipient's payment was mailed, they should watch their mail for either a paper check or debit card. The debit cards arrive in a white envelope that prominently displays the U.S. Department of the Treasury seal. The prepaid debit card, called the Economic Impact Payment Card, is issued by Treasury's financial agent, MetaBank N.A. The IRS does not determine who receives a card. The form of payment for the second mailed EIP may be different than the first mailed EIP. Some people who received a paper check last time might receive a prepaid debit card this time, and some people who received a prepaid debit card last time may receive a paper check. EIP cards are safe, convenient, and secure. These cards provide certain protections against fraud, loss, and other errors. They can be used to make purchases online or in stores anywhere Visa debit cards are accepted. Cardholders can also use the cards to do any of the following without paying a fee. Transfer funds to a personal bank account. Make signature or PIN debit purchases anywhere Visa debit cards are accepted, in stores, online, or over the phone. Get cash back with a PIN debit purchase where available. Get cash from in-network ATMs. Get a replacement EIP card if needed. Check their card balance online through a mobile app or by phone. People should watch their mail carefully. EIP cards are being sent in a white envelope that prominently displays the U.S. Department of the Treasury seal. The envelope also states, "Not a bill or an advertisement, important information about your economic impact payment." The EIP card has the Visa name on the front of the card and the issuing bank name, MetaBank NA, on the back. Each mailing will include instructions on how to securely activate and use the EIP card. These cards are being issued to eligible recipients across all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Residents of the Western United States are generally more likely to receive an EIP card. People can check the status of their payment using the website https://www.irs.gov/coronavirus/get-my-payment. Get My Payment tool on the irs.gov website. Next, the obituaries. Vicki L. Burns. Vicki Lynn Burns, 69, of Moline, passed away Thursday, December 31st at her residence. Robert W. Shriver. Robert W. Shriver, 58, of Tuscola, passed away at 5:48 p.m. on Sunday, January 17th at his home. There will be no services held. Noah B. Helmuth. Noah B. Helmuth, 96, of Harrisonburg, Virginia, formerly of Arthur, passed away on Tuesday, January 12th at the Virginia Mennonite Retirement Community, where he was a resident for the past 8 years. Private family graveside services were held on Saturday, January 16th in the Arthur Cemetery. Reverend Michael Loss officiated. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, gifts may be made to VMRC Foundation Good Samaritan Fund, 1491 Virginia Avenue. Luis A. Gonzalez. Luis A. Gonzalez, 62, of Newman, formerly of Arcola, passed away at 9:47 p.m. on Saturday, January 16th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A private funeral mass was held at 7 p.m. on Thursday, January 21st at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Arcola. Father Angel Sierra officiated. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Janice K. Wetzel. Janice K. Wetzel, 85, of Tuscola, formerly Chicago, died Saturday, January 16th at home. Memorial contributions may be made in her honor to an organization of the donor's choice. Teresa Fields. Teresa Fields, 69, of Villa Grove, passed away at 7:30 p.m. on January 7th at Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital in Mattoon with her husband by her side. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made at the Villa Grove State Bank for the Teresa Fields Scholarship Fund for Villa Grove High School students or to the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Tuscola in her name. A funeral service was held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, January 13th at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Tuscola, where Reverend Jason Bratton officiated. Burial followed at the Villa Grove Cemetery in Villa Grove. Anne Drescher. Anne Drescher of Lake Worth, Florida, formerly from Villa Grove, died at home under hospice care on December 28th. She will be buried next to her husband at Villa Grove Cemetery. She requested no service. Betty J. Thoman. Betty J. Thoman, or Thoman, age 95, of Kingston, Tennessee, passed away Sunday, January 10th at Methodist Medical Center in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. A celebration of life will be held at a later date in Vandalia and will be announced once the information becomes available. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Tuscola United Methodist Church, SAM Pantry at 901 North Prairie, Tuscola, 61953. Fraker Funeral Home of Kingston, Tennessee is in charge of all the arrangements. James O. Sudkamp. James O. Sudkamp, 90, of Newman, formerly of Sadorus and Effingham, passed away on Sunday, January 10th. Memorials in James' name can be made to the American Legion or the Tuscola Moose Law. Services will be private. Hillegoss Schrader Funeral Home, Tuscola, is assisting the family with the arrangements. Lily Joyce Dalzell. Lily Joyce Dalzell, 73, of Villa Grove, died at 12:04 a.m. on January 2nd at Pleasant Meadows Senior Living in Chrisman. A graveside service was held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, January 16th at the Murdoch Cemetery, and Mr. Ted Shearer officiated. Joyce's Funeral Home of Villa Grove is assisting the family with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the National MS Society or to the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Michael D. Wolfe. Michael D. Wolfe, 74, of Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, passed away peacefully on December 18th at Hilton Head Hospital. A celebration of life with friends and family will be held in the spring. Memorial contributions in Michael's name can be sent to St. Luke's Church, 50 Pope Avenue, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, 29928. Jerry Jean. Jerry Jean, 66, of Arcola, passed away at 1:56 p.m. on Friday, January 8th at his residence. Private family services will be held. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting. Ellen L. Nelson. Ellen L. Nelson, 60, of Charleston, passed away at 4:34 p.m. on Sunday, January 17th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. A memorial service was held at 4 p.m. on Saturday, January 23rd at the Edwards Funeral Home in Arcola. Memorials may be made to the family. Norma L. Cox. Norma Louise Cox of Villa Grove passed away peacefully at Newman Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center on January 10th. Due to COVID, a private family graveside service was held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, January 14th at the Fairfield Cemetery with Mr. Ted Shearer officiating. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Murdoch United Methodist Church. Donald V. Cherwanka. Donald V. Cherwanka, 92, of Tuscola, passed away at 6:35 p.m. Monday, January 11th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Funeral services were held at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 16th at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church with Pastor Jason Broughton officiating. Burial followed in the St. Paul's Lutheran Cemetery in Siegel with military graveside rites accorded. Visitation was held 1 hour prior to the services at the church. Hillegoss Schrader Funeral Home in Tuscola is assisting the family. Ned R. Douglas. Ned R. Douglas, 84, of Hinesboro, passed away at 4:12 p.m. on Sunday, January 17th at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center in Mattoon. Private funeral services were held on Wednesday, January 20th at the Edwards Funeral Home. Reverend Zandra Anderson officiated. Burial will be in the Van Voorhees Cemetery at a later date. Friends were welcome to pay their respects to Ned and sign the register book between 1 and 3 p.m. on Wednesday, January 20th at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Hinesboro Volunteer Fire Department. Next article, Ag in the Classroom discusses dairy farming. The Ag in the Classroom topic this month has been dairy farming. Dairy cows are an amazing animal, able to turn grass and silage into milk by the gallons. A dairy cow will eat 100 pounds of feed and drink 25 to 50 gallons of water each day. A cow then can produce 7 to 8 gallons of milk per day. It takes about 2 days for milk to go from the farm to the retail store. Students learned about different breeds of dairy cattle. Some cows, such as Holsteins, are used for the large quantity of milk they produce. Other cows, like the Brown Swiss breed, are chosen because they produce a very rich, velvety milk that is high in butterfat. This milk can be used to produce delicious cheese. Still other cows are chosen because of their size or grazing habits. Jersey cows are a smaller breed and do not take as much land or feed to maintain. Milking Shorthorns are better able to utilize pasture grasses, thus not requiring as much feed. Almost 97% of dairy farms are family-owned. Dairy farmers work extremely hard to produce a safe and wholesome source of dairy products for the public. Dairy farmers protect the land, water, and air not only for their animals, but also their families and surrounding community. Dairy products provide your body with calcium, which is needed for healthy bones and teeth. Calcium also helps our muscles and nerves to work properly and helps blood to clot. Children need 3 servings of dairy products every day. Low-fat dairy foods improve overall diet quality. Douglas County Ag in the Classroom is supported by Douglas County Farm Bureau, Douglas County Ag Center, and Illinois Ag in the Classroom. Next article, Road and Bridge Subcommittee Discuss Updates, by Jim Allen. The Road and Bridge Subcommittee met on January 13th at 9 o'clock with Don Munson, Dick Hine, and Gary Luth present. Jim Crane, county engineer, and guests were also present. Work is ongoing for Cronus Chemicals, but there is nothing new to report. Chastain and Associates have submitted plans that are 60% complete for the roadwork to be done in the Harvest Ridge Wind Farm. Currently, the plans are over 325 pages. The final inspections for culvert and bridges is complete, and work will begin after Chastain and Associates have completed plans for the roadwork and weather is acceptable to begin reconstruction. As specified in the road use agreement, the roads will be built 16 feet wide. Before the wind farm complex was built, the roads were anywhere from 12 to 22 feet wide. The right-of-way for township roads is 40 feet, so a 16-foot road will allow for proper drainage ditches. Jim Crane gave a detailed explanation of the rebuilding of the roads. The subcommittee recommended to the full board the approval of $228,000 in matching funds for a bridge over the Kaskaskia River on County Highway 6 at 1450 North in Garrett Township. The project will be out for bids in March with the work to be started by June. It will be an 80 working day contract. This allows for inclement weather when work cannot be performed. The total cost for the project is estimated to be $1,410,000, with a county responsible for $228,000. Mr. Crane presented a general maintenance appropriation of MFT motor fuel tax of $349,900. The committee will soon recommend this to the full board at the next regular county board meeting. Interview with consultants in the bridge project will be scheduled in February. On a personal note, hats off to Jim Crane for his work in completing the necessary paperwork. Author's comment, I can't begin to know what he is facing and taking the time to explain it to those present. To have an engineer who is able to explain what is taking place to the average person is priceless. And that's it for this week's Tri-County Journal. This has been Nicolene Ambrose reading with you. I look forward to reading with you again soon.